Ladies and gentlemen, this is Santa Clara County Supervisor Joe Simidi, and I want to welcome you to our third telephone town hall regarding COVID-19, the coronavirus. And as I mentioned, this is the third in a series of telephone town halls designed to make sure that we are keeping you current on what's happening here at the county and in our county, steps you can take to make sure you're keeping yourself safe and to the greatest degree possible, also sharing with you what we think the future holds. As I say, I'm Santa Clara County Supervisor Joe Simidian. I represent the 5th Supervisorial District, which is the north and west parts of our county. Some of you have been constituents of mine previously when I served in the California State Senate or at the local level. But regardless of who you are and where you live or work in Santa Clara County, we welcome you to the call today. We have a really talented and knowledgeable panel today. I thank them all in advance for their participation. We're going to be working with our county counsel, James Williams. The county counsel is the chief legal officer for our Santa Clara County organization, and among the county counsel's duties are the responsibility to serve as legal advisor to our Board of Supervisors, the county executive, and all the other elected officials and department heads and their staffs here in Santa Clara County. So it's a big job with probably something like 200 employees. And again, that's James Williams, who is our county counsel. And they oversee all of the litigation in which our county is named, including litigation that's brought on behalf of county residents. I should mention that Mr. Williams, prior to becoming our county counsel, had also worked in the county executive's office, so he has operational experience as well as the legal expertise. And particularly critical to today's conversation, he is one of the rotating directors of our EOC, the Emergency Operations Center, so he is literally on duty and is going to be joining us today from the EOC, our Emergency Operations Center. He comes to us very well credentialed, BA from Princeton in international affairs, and after that, a law degree from Stanford University. He's been here at the county with us for 10 years, and again, James Williams, both our county counsel and one of the rotating directors of our Emergency Operations Center. We'll also have back with us, and we appreciate it, Dr. Sarah Cody. Dr. Cody, as many of you have learned over these past couple of months, is the public health officer for Santa Clara County. She received her undergraduate degree at Stanford and her MD from Yale University. She's been with the county for more than 20 years, has been public health officer here for the past 7, and I'm particularly pleased that earlier in her career she had fellowship opportunities with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which means these kinds of issues have been part and parcel of her work for a very long time indeed. I'm also pleased that both Mr. Williams and Dr. Cody live here in Santa Clara County. And so for them, this is very real, very personal, and very immediate, as well as obviously a matter of professional concern. But then we'll be able to hear from two folks who are serving us here locally, Dr. Mark Adams from El Camino Hospital and Dr. Yvonne Maldonado from Stanford, and both bring really helpful insight and experience. Dr. Adams is the chief medical officer at El Camino Hospital. He received both his bachelor's degree and his MD from the University of Pennsylvania, but he's got something like 30 years of experience in healthcare administration around the country. So he brings a national perspective and is himself a board-certified vascular surgeon. And then, as I mentioned, we also have Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, who is the chief of the Division of Infection Diseases at Stanford Medicine and medical director of infection prevention and control at Lucile Packard Hospital, the Children's Hospital at Stanford. Here again, a long-time career in epidemiology, prevention of viral infections, and her work has taken her around the globe. So she has familiarity not only with these issues here in the United States, but everywhere from Latin America to the Africa to Africa as well. So, lots of good folks today. I'm going to kick it off by asking some questions of each of our guests, but we want to remind everyone that if you dial 9 at any point in the conversation, then we will have an opportunity to take your question. There is a limit, of course, to the number of questions we get to, so please understand if we can't get to each and every question. But if you'd like to ask a question at any time during the, probably hour and a half that we'll be on today, please just press 9. So with all of that having been said, a reminder that if you're looking for additional information, it can be found on the Santa Clara County Public Health Department's website and Facebook page, and really lots of good information. Lots of good information on that website. I just Google Santa Clara County coronavirus and have access to all the information at my fingertips. You can also, of course, go to my page at County Supervisor Joe Simidian and or look at the Facebook page there as well. And I just want to encourage everyone to offer up their questions by dialing 9 at any point in the process. And we will have an opportunity at the end of the call as well for those of you who'd like to just leave a comment, make a suggestion, let us know what you think to do so. And please know that I hear and or see a transcript of each and every one of those comments. So thank you for that. All right. I think at this point, let me go to Mr. James Williams. And as I mentioned earlier, Mr. Williams is our county counsel. That means he's the legal counsel for our county. Mr. Williams, that alone would be more than enough to keep you busy, but you are also part of our EOC, our Emergency Operations Center team, and one of the rotating heads of that operation. So thank you for making time. My understanding is that you've literally stepped into a room at the EOC. And let me just welcome you again. And James Williams, let me just ask, we've got a shelter-in-place order that is now in place, has been since earlier this month. It replaced an earlier order. There's always, plenty of questions about the provisions of the order. So could you offer your thoughts about, what the current requirements are for the shelter-in-place order, and perhaps clarify any issues that you think have been the source of some concern or confusion along the way? Again, thank you to James Williams. Go right ahead, Mr. Williams.
Good morning, and first of all, just thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be able to talk with you and to talk with the residents of the Supervisorial District, which happens to be where I live, too. So this is a wonderful opportunity, so thank you. You are right. I'm talking to you from the county EOC, and there's always a lot of activity 7 days a week. And you're also right. Many of the questions that we do get involve, what is the current status of the shelter-in-place order? And we get a lot of questions that come in about the specifics around the order. And I think the first thing that I would share regarding that is really, what is the top line here? What is the purpose and the point behind shelter in place? And I think if you focus on that, that kind of top line, then many of the questions or issues or nuances around, what may or may not be an essential business or what may or may not be a specific activity kind of fall by the wayside a little bit. And so that top line is that the purpose behind shelter in place is to reduce the volume of social interaction. And, we are social beings, all of us, but the purpose is to limit the amount of interaction that we have with those outside of our household in order to reduce the spread of COVID-19. And everything is built around that purpose. And so the order itself, which contains restrictions on gatherings and restrictions on travel and that delineates what kinds of businesses can be open.
Mr. Williams, we appear to have lost you. Are you still with us? Dr. Cody, are you still with us? All right. Well, forgive me, callers. We have a brief interruption, but I think what we were hearing from Mr. Williams, and we'll get him back on the line as quickly as we possibly can, is the fairly common sense notion of trying to limit the number of interactions that any of us might have with other folks here in the county, trying to limit the time, meaning the amount of time that we have those interactions, and trying to limit as well the frequency for that kind of interaction. And so if we have fewer interactions and they are of shorter duration and they are greater distance, then we are likely to find ourselves in a better place. Mr. Williams, do we have you back on yet or no?
You do.
Thank you.
I'm not sure what happened, but yes, I'm back.
All right. It's a nastier virus than we realized, apparently, if it can bug our phones as well. So I was just saying, bottom line coming from you is to limit the number of interactions, limit the frequency of those interactions, and try and provide as much distance as possible. And no disrespect to the 20 pages of legal documents that I know have been churned out, but it sounds to me like if we focus on those three things, we have most of it, yes?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And of course, there are lots of questions about the nuance of that, but I think people should really focus on that top line. And that, and by focusing on that, I think much of the rest follows.
Yeah, many years ago when I was a student at Palo Alto High School, I had a social studies teacher, Lois Walsh, bless her, and I remember her saying one day in class that if I spent as much time working on the term paper as I did trying to figure out how I could get around the rules, that I'd be turning in a really great term paper. So I take your counsel that I and all of us should just say, okay, the details do matter, but bottom line, stay focused on limited interactions, limited duration, and maximizing the distance. Well, I'm just curious, what else do you feel, you know, over the last few weeks has been the subject of the greatest number of calls or inquiries, Mr. Williams?
Well, we've gotten a lot of questions. So, you know, the most recent order, we were able to open up some new categories, namely construction and outdoor businesses and outdoor activities. And I think most of the questions have really, in terms of volume of questions, have really been in this category of outdoor activities, you know, recreational activities and other things that have opened up. And, you know, again, I think the you know, there's a lot of specifics about this thing and that thing and some challenging overlap with the state order, because we do have to abide by the restrictions in the state order, and sometimes they haven't been exactly in sync, so that has been a challenge. But, you know, I think the thing to remember on the outdoor activities piece is that we're trying to avoid interactions between household units where folks might be coming into personal contact or sharing equipment. And so that's really the basis, the kind of core basis for a lot of the more specific answers. We do have guides on the website. We do have detailed FAQs. We do try to answer these more nuanced questions. But I think a lot of them flow on this outdoor activities category from that basic principle of trying to avoid physical interaction between different living units through either, whether that be through shared equipment or direct physical contact.
Well, thanks for that. I do think we've had the same experience in my office. The questions that have come through have largely been about the opening up issues, meaning that once you open things up a little bit, people want to understand just what the nature and extent of that new order might entail. And yes, we've had the same experience, which is that folks who hear one thing at the federal level, another thing at the state level, and then a different thing here at the county level are understandably challenged sometimes to try and determine just what is applicable to them. I will encourage folks, as you have, to make their way to that county webpage. A lot of good information there, more and more with every day. It keeps being updated. A lot of good information on the frequently asked questions, the FAQs. And if people get stuck, you know, please feel free to call your county supervisor, whoever he or she may be. Please feel free to call my office. We will be able to direct you to an answer more often than not. And if we can't do it immediately, we'll find someone who can. So thank you for that. I'm also curious, and again, we're talking with James Williams, who is our county counsel here at Santa Clara County. Based on, you know, what we're hearing in my office from a lot of county residents, you know, there are concerns out there that not everyone is respecting the shelter-in-place order, and that the actions of others are putting local folks at risk. I'm just curious, you know, understanding that, as you just pointed out, not everyone is subject to the same set of regulations depending on the work they do. What would you recommend to county residents if they see someone they think is either putting themselves or others at risk?
Yeah, this is a real challenging one. We've obviously gotten lots and lots and lots of enforcement-related inquiries or complaints. The district attorney's office has done a great job. They've got a website, they've got a web form, and they've got an email address, which I'll just provide for folks, which is pubhealthreferral, pubhealthreferral, at eao.scc.gov.org, but they also have a web form. But that's really a better mechanism for the question of, you know, businesses that maybe should or should not be open or what's happening there. I think the harder one is, you know, what about individuals and risk associated with individual activity? And here's where we need everyone to work together to change some culture norms, you know, whether it's face masking or social distancing as, you know, folks are passing by or in a park or something like that or on a hiking trail. It's about norms. And I think, you know, the best message there is obviously people should be accountable for their own behavior, but also send the message to family and friends. You know, we do need to be face masking. We do need to be maintaining social distancing. We do need to have impeccable hygiene. And the better that we all collectively do in those areas, the greater control we will have collectively as a county over the virus, and therefore the better our pathway towards being able to fully reopen. And so, you know, keeping that in mind. But that's a cultural issue, and that's not going to be answered by law enforcement. That's not going to be answered by the DA's office. That's going to be answered by how each of us individually behaves when we are out and about.
Got it. And I'm just curious if you can give listeners a rough sense of the scope, excuse me, the number of complaints that our district attorney's office has gotten. Is that something measured in the dozens, the hundreds, the thousands? What level of thousands? Okay.
The thousands. All right. And many of them, like I said, do fall into this more individual interaction. And those are just not, you know, very easy for law enforcement to deal with. But the business-related ones are more in their bailiwick, and I do know that there has been a lot of follow-up on those and real diligence in trying to first educate and encourage full compliance, and then where unfortunately necessary, follow-up with the penalties that are provided for under the law.
All right, then. And the last question before we go on to Dr. Sarah Cody, Mr. Williams, is, you know, it strikes me, you've been more or less embedded at the county's EOC, our Emergency Operations Center, for the past 2 months now. I'm just curious, and I think our listeners will be as well, are there insights you've taken away from sort of being the eye of the hurricane here for the last 2 months that can help us make our way through the rest of the pandemic? You clearly have some opportunity now after 2 months to reflect and say, well, looking forward, it's important that we think about this. What is that, if I can ask you to fill in that blank?
Yeah, it really has been interesting. You know, so before I became county council, as you noted, I was a deputy county executive, and one of my responsibilities was to oversight of the Office of Emergency Management and our EOC. And so for years now, you know, been training along with folks around things like preparing for an earthquake or another type of disaster, fire season, things like that. But this is truly unprecedented. This is a different kind of event in many ways. And a couple of things that I've really observed in this kind of event. One is just how the county has come together. It has been truly impressive. We moved first, we moved aggressively, and our community has delivered those collective results. At the beginning of this, we represented, you know, I think at one point we were 20% of the cases in the entire United States. And now we have dropped even below, I think, our population share in the state of California. That's because of our ability as a community to come together and respond so effectively. That's just been impressive to behold, and that's something that will serve us very well as we move forward because we're not done yet. The other thing that's been interesting and different from all of the training and all of the EOC work from all these years is that traditionally in an emergency, we rely on mutual aid. You know, you have an earthquake in one part of the country or a flood or a hurricane, and a bunch of resources pour in from the rest of the country. This event is very different because the whole nation and the whole world is affected. And so we have had to be resilient and utilize local resources in a way that's very different without being able to access some of the supplies or things from the state or federal level. And I expect that that will unfortunately continue as well. And I think we have worked really hard to stand up some local systems to try to deal with some of the federal and state inability to provide certain things, whether it's PPE or testing or other things, and we'll need to continue to collectively be able to move forward on those items for many, many months to come.
Well, thank you. We're going to keep James Williams, our county counsel, and one of our rotating directors at the Emergency Operations Center on the line with us so that we can get to questions in just a little bit, but we've got a couple of other guests we want to make sure we get to. And before we get to our next guest, Dr. Sarah Cody, our public health officer, we have a poll question that we've asked for each of the last two calls we've done, and we're going to ask it again today. And it's been interesting to see how the results have changed with the passage of time. And here's the question. The question is, which of the following most concerns you about the COVID-19 outbreak? And I'm going to give you four options and ask folks to press the number that corresponds to their answer. And, you know, a disclaimer, this is obviously not a random sample. We've got interested folks on the line, and there are certainly other legitimate concerns. And I'll provide these numbers twice, so don't worry if I walk past it. But I'd like to ask, press one if the thing you're most concerned about is at-risk relatives and friends or colleagues, including the elderly. Press two if you're most concerned about the ability of our hospitals and our medical staffs to respond to the outbreak, to essentially keep up without being overwhelmed. Press three if you're most concerned about the loss of jobs and the effect that all of this is having on our economy and small businesses in particular. And press four if you're most concerned about the ability of students in our area to receive an adequate education, given the fact that schools and universities have either had to close or pursue distance learning. So again, that's one, if you're most concerned about at-risk relatives, friends, colleagues, including the elderly. Press two, if you're most concerned about our hospitals and medical system being overwhelmed and keeping up. And press three, if you're most concerned about the loss of jobs and or the effect that this is having on our economy and small businesses. And press four, if you are most concerned about our students' ability to receive an adequate education while schools and universities have been forced to either close or pursue distance learning. Thank you. And we'll announce the results of the poll in just a little bit. But again, appreciate your weighing in just so we have a sense for what is top of mind for all of you. And as I mentioned, now we have that chance to move to Dr. Sarah Cody, who is our public health officer here at the county and who's been with the county for more than 20 years. Dr. Cody, can you hear us loud and clear?
I certainly can.
Well, thank you. Here's the thing. I know it's the question I get, and I'm guessing it's the question that gets to you all the time, which is the current shelter-in-place order is set to expire in a couple of weeks. So not to put you on the spot too much, but what can you tell us about what residents should expect for the next shelter-in-place order and when we might see it and how it might change?
Sure. Thank you for the question, Supervisor Simidi, and I'm more than happy to give everyone a sense of where we are and how we are thinking about this pandemic and how it's playing out in our community. First, before I do that, though, I want to just emphasize something that you said in your introductions, which is that our website has a dashboard. So we want everyone to be able to follow along and see the metrics that we're hitting and how we're doing. And as we all know, Supervisor Simidian is always the champion in our community and our county for transparency data. So thank you, Supervisor Simidian. I think that it's your efforts and leadership in that area that really got us going and got that dashboard up. So we really want everyone to see how we're doing. In general, our shelter-in-place order, as James mentioned, has been, our community has really responded and everyone has done their part. And we have seen the levels of transmission in Santa Clara County go way, way, way down. So the way we're approaching this, I think you can see on the dashboard that our hospitals are in good shape. There's a lot of capacity to care for patients, both those with COVID and those without. And we now know that there's also adequate PPE in our hospitals. So this is excellent news. So the question that we get and that you asked is, so what's next? What does this mean? And the approach that we are taking here and with many of the counties in the region is to keep it safe. So if we inched forward with opening construction and outdoor recreation and outdoor activities, and we're looking very closely to see whether that has had an impact and whether we see any little areas of transmission or not. When it looks like it's staying pretty level and pretty safe, then we'll inch forward and open additional businesses and sectors. I want to say, and James touched on this as well, the state, we can't get ahead of the state order. And so when they're in one phase or stage, we can't go beyond that. So it's essentially as though the state provides a little menu, and when we feel that it's safe in our community to open a little further, we can just pick from the limited menu of the state and then proceed like that. We can't, for example, jump ahead and say we'd like to open schools, that's our first priority, because those don't come till much later in the state order. I also just want to emphasize that our goal is to make sure that our community not only feels safe, but is safe, so that when a sector does open, people can go and access goods and services with all the social distancing protections in place and know that it's safe. Because I think that when we bring additional sectors online, our economy may recover faster if people are accessing those goods and services because they can see by looking at the data that levels of virus in our community are low. And we are going to work very hard together to keep it that way to the best of our ability.
Got it. Thank you. And forgive me because my phone cut out just briefly. So when do we think we might, if you've already said this, I apologize, but if not, I want to make sure that I do the best I can. When do we think we're going to hear again from you and or your colleagues in other counties?
Well, what I can tell you is I committed when we renewed the order at the beginning of May that we would be watching our indicators every day. And hoping that we will, we play our cards fairly close to our chest, as you know. But as we look at these indicators collectively, when we at the first moment that we think it's safe to take another step without jeopardizing the progress that we've made, we will do so. And it is our great hope that we will be able to do, to do that before the order actually expires. But we really need to have it based on our data and be able to assure communities in our county that it really is safe.
And Dr. Cody, you were kind enough a few minutes ago to talk about my pushing for transparency, and yet you said, and I appreciate your candor, that to some extent it's your practice in Santa Clara County as our public health officer who has the authority to make these decisions, I should underscore for people on the phone, to sort of play your cards relatively close to your vest. Why is that? Why do you think that's important? And how does that differ from between and among other counties? You know, I think part of the challenge for folks who live in a region like the Bay Area is that if one county does something one way and one county does something the other way, it's not only confusing, but it can undermine confidence in the legitimacy of the direction. So what are your thoughts about that?
Yes. One of the key aspects of response to this whole event has been communication. And as you know, it's extraordinarily complex. It's not only communicating to the residents, people who live and work in our county, but it's coordinating as a region. And of course, we live in this very federated system, which in an event like this has been enormously challenging. And that's why around the Bay Area as a region, we've been doing everything that we can to work as a region, because that's how we really function. But it's enormously complex. And so one of the reasons to sort of keep our cards close, it's to enable time to be coordinated and to communicate together to the best that we can.
Dr. Cody, I'm going to put that in layman's language, and you tell me if I got it right. Was that your way of saying we shouldn't be talking about this stuff until we know what we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. I thought that's what you were trying to say ever so politely and professionally, but I just wanted to sort of bottom line it. And again, for those of you who've just joined us, this is Santa Clara County Supervisor Joe Simidian. This is our telephone town hall on COVID-19. We have been speaking with our county council, James Williams. We are now speaking with our public health officer, Dr. Sarah Cody, and we will have other guests on as well. If you have a question you'd like to ask, and we are getting a number of questions I see, please press 9 to get yourself in the queue for questions. So one more question for you, Dr. Cody, before we go on to other issues, and that is, what's the... As you know, over the past couple of months, I've been pushing on the issue of testing, and I'm certainly not alone in that regard. What's the magic number of tests, if there is a magic number, that we need to, you know, sort of be on a path back to normal, to open things up a bit more? And perhaps most importantly, how do we get there? So the issue of testing and what kind of numbers we need and also how do we get there? Thoughts?
Yes, so we have set a initial goal of 4,000 tests a day across the county, but that number is by no means magic. That number was arrived at by looking at targets that various other groups had set, number of tests per population, and coming to a place around the region that where we thought that it was a goal that we could all get to. So, but I would describe it as an initial goal, not ultimately as much as we may need. So we're, you know, continuing to learn more. But I think what's most important, and I really want to emphasize, it's about who we test and how we're using the tests that we have. So since we put that shelter-in-place order, we've learned a lot more about how many people can have no symptoms and still be infectious and spreading infection. And so we want to make sure that we have enough testing going on so that we pick up even those people who have no symptoms but might be spreading the virus. So there's a couple different groups where we want to make sure that when we deploy all those tests, we're really reaching some really important groups. The first would be anyone who has symptoms of COVID. We want to make sure that they get tested as early as possible to either confirm that those symptoms are indeed from a COVID infection or that they're not. Second, we want to make sure that anyone who might be at risk of bringing COVID in to a vulnerable group, for example, a skilled nursing facility or other long-term care facility where people who are older or may be more likely to have underlying illness that puts them at risk, we want to make sure that all those folks get tested so that we want to prevent an outbreak by testing people who work in those settings. And the final group is, we know that we haven't completely, you know, wiped out the virus in our county, and that people who work in occupations where they have a lot of frequent contact with the public, they just have a greater chance of being exposed and therefore of being infected. And so it's important that we focus testing on those groups as well. So that would be, for example, you work in a grocery store. You know, you're performing an essential activity, and there's a lot of contact with the public. Or, you know, you work in transit, driving a bus, for example. That's another type of occupation where you have a lot of contact with the public and therefore more likely to get infection. And we want to make sure that those folks get tested frequently so that we can protect them and keep those workplaces safe as well.
Got it. Thank you. And, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to one more thing you, if I can, please. And that is, it occurred to me as I was listening to you that our county executive, Dr. Jeff Smith, who is also a medical doctor, from time to time mentions the Spanish influenza, the Spanish flu that plagued Americans in the beginning of the 20th century. And particularly when we're talking about the expected cycle of COVID, and he mentions from time to time that there were multiple spikes in reported cases and that the disease, Spanish flu back in the day, did not have just one major surge of reported cases. I'm just curious your thought about the potential for additional spikes, whether we can, should expect them, how many, and perhaps most importantly, how are we preparing for those spikes if and when they come?
So as far as anticipating when the spikes might be and how many of them, I think that largely depends on the actions and behaviors and policies outside of our county. So we could do everything in our collective power in the county, but if that's not what's happening in surrounding jurisdictions and states, there's probably not a lot that we could do to prevent another spike. So the answer is we don't know, but many are predicting that there will be additional waves, you know, perhaps in the fall, perhaps later than that, and that we need to really play the long game. And to that end, as far as how we're preparing for this long game, I think it goes to many of the items that James touched on, which is our whole county infrastructure and collaboration with other partners in the community to keep doing what we're doing. So, for example, we're going to need to keep the entire infrastructure in place to do to ensure that there's widespread testing, because that enables us to have our detection system and know where we have virus spreading or not. And similarly, we're going to have to keep our entire infrastructure for case investigation and contact tracing. And then if we see that it doesn't look safe and there's a lot of more virus circulating and it ticks up again, then we may, of course, need to tighten up the shelter in place again. So really we're preparing by ensuring that the infrastructure that we're building is solid and that we can sustain it over the long term.
Got it. And I think I was struck by something you said, Dr. Cody, just before we go on to our final pair of speakers, and that was when you said we don't know. And I think when you're confronting a new phenomenon and there are things we don't know, number one, it's important to say that there are things we don't know. And number two, as you point out, to then prepare for the unexpected, because if we don't know, we don't know, and we need to be ready for whatever comes at us. So thank you for all of that. And thank you for your willingness to stay on the call. We want to go next to Dr. Mark Adams and Dr. Yvonne Maldonado. Dr. Adams, as I mentioned earlier, is the chief medical officer at El Camino Hospital with 30 years of experience in healthcare around the country and a surgeon himself. Dr. Maldonado is the chief of the Division of Infection Disease at Stanford Medicine and medical director of infection prevention and control at Lucile Packer Children's Hospital at Stanford. So thank you to you both. And Dr. Maldonado, I just, as I mentioned earlier in the call, you have a background studying infectious diseases. I'm just curious, you know, at this point, a few months in, what's the difference, and or what's different, I guess, and what's the same about COVID-19 from other infectious diseases you've confronted over the course of your career?
Yes, that's a great question. So this is, it's a, first of all, it's a unique virus. We haven't seen it before. It's very similar that way to the pandemic influenza strain that we saw in 2009, which had never been seen in our lifetime and had some similarities actually to the 1918 pandemic influenza strain, not identical, but similar. But I think one of the issues here, I like to think of it as, what if the common cold, which spreads very easily, actually made us very sick? That's exactly what we're facing. We're facing a disease that's very common that can affect everybody, but as opposed to the common cold, which you can generally get over, and actually, unfortunately, people go to work with it sometimes, but you can actually work through it. This version of the common cold, which it really is, can actually cause people quite significant disability, hospitalization, ventilatory support, and as you have seen, even death. And so this is a kind of a bad trifecta, if you will, of very commonly spread, spread around the world, with no immunity, and also has a significant bad long-term, short-term and long-term outcomes as far as we know at this point. And that's why we are so concerned, because the way this virus is transmitted, as far as we know at this point, appears to be through a very high level of virus that's present in the nose and the mouth, but mostly in the nose. And as we have seen over and over again, these droplets can be spread very easily around your environment. And so it's really a matter of controlling those droplets, but it's, as you know, socially, it's very hard for us to do that.
Got it. Let me ask Dr. Adams from El Camino Hospital. Dr. Adams, we talked earlier about the possibility or the potential for COVID having multiple spikes in cases. I'm just curious what El Camino Hospital is doing to prepare for the potential or possibility of future spikes if we have a recurrence, essentially, of the phenomenon.
Well, I think as people have pointed out already, this is going to be with us, you know, for the near term, at least the next year. It could take a long time to develop a vaccine, so we do have to be prepared to live with it going forward. And so we have made some changes in our facilities to really have certain areas that can be easily quarantined with negative air pressure, and that we can isolate people easily and efficiently. But at the same time, you know, we still have to get back to taking care of people's all their other illnesses and problems. Which has been an issue, as you know, that people, for various reasons, have been reluctant to seek health care to the point where we've seen people with advanced strokes who waited too long. We've seen people with heart attacks that have waited too long and now have heart damage. People coming in with diabetes that has been out of control for days and sometimes weeks. And so we are prepared, we have to be prepared to do both. Right now, we don't have any COVID positive patients in our hospital, and so that's good, but we don't expect that that will continue. And as we sort of lighten up and start to get back to regular business, I think we will continue to have to be able to take care of patients like that. I will say this, we have learned a lot in these last 2 months about how to take care of these patients. We have had some really great successes. We just sent a gentleman home on Friday who had been in for 2 months with terrible respiratory disease on a ventilator, actually on extracorporeal mechanical oxygenation. and finally went home. And so, again, we've learned a lot on how to take care of these patients, and we can do it. But I'm very concerned about people not understanding that they can now get regular health care. And by the way, you know, the socioeconomic impact, which we have to consider, is really affecting physicians especially hard. There's a lot of physicians and their practices that are near bankrupt. And so, again, that's another concern that we've had. Our healthcare infrastructure is really, you know, being undermined pretty significantly as well. So there's a lot of factors, a lot of unknowns, but we have to sort of move ahead and be willing and able to deal with all these contingencies at the same time.
Dr. Adams, thank you. And I just
can I add something? This is Dr. Maldonado. Can I just add something? I think this is
please.
Critical. Yeah, it's a critical point that Dr. Adams makes. And I would also like to say that I do think we're going to see this virus come back. But as importantly, we're seeing extremely dramatic plunging of vaccination rates in children, 70% reductions in normal vaccination rates. And we might actually risk seeing other diseases come back overlaid on this pandemic. And so we really want to make sure that people get their children or have their grandkids, make sure their grandkids or the whole spectrum of children get their proper vaccines now, because we know that those diseases are just lurking around the corner as well.
Thank you both. And I before I go back to Dr. Maldonado with a question, Dr. Adams, there was so much information there between you, the two of you. I just want to underscore what I heard, and perhaps I grabbed onto it because I think it's a bit of a silver lining, even if it's a thin silver lining, is that if and when we are confronted with another spike, our healthcare systems, including El Camino, will be even better prepared by virtue of having had this experience. Is that a fair characterization?
It is, and we've learned a lot in the last 2 months. And also, by the way, now that testing is at least more available for us, you know, we are in the process of testing all of our healthcare workers. We've tested all of our physicians who do procedures. And so we think, and we test every patient now who needs to come in for a procedure. And so we think we're in a much better place than we were 2 months ago.
Great. Dr. Maldonado, before I move us along, I am curious about an issue that has gotten some increasing attention, and that's about kids, children who may be asymptomatic carriers, meaning that they may be infected with COVID but are showing no symptoms. Is there current research on this that you think it would be helpful for us to know about and understand a little?
Yeah, that's a really important question, and many of us are trying to figure out how to answer that question. And the reason it's so hard to do is you have to be able to understand, get large numbers of children and test them, like we're doing with healthcare workers and other essential providers where they are in constant circulation in the communities now. The issue with kids is most of them are at home, so even if you could get to children and draw blood, for example, or do PCR testing, they're still isolated, so that's not really a good marker of what might be happening if you brought them back into a community. So we had tried to do a school-based study in February, March, but the schools closed before we could do that. So we don't really have a good sense of what would happen if a child got infected or what's the dynamic there. What would happen if children were infected? Would they spread it or not? And so that's why people are so concerned about the fall. But what we are seeing, though, is that children, for some reason, seem not to be getting infected in the same numbers as adults. They are seeing some different syndromes, but which are unusual manifestations that do tell us something more about the virus and how it works. But we need to understand better what's going on. I'm doing, and others are doing, household transmission studies where we're testing everybody in a household where we know one person's infected. But that really only tells you what happens in one household. You have to accumulate lots of households to kind of study what the dynamic is. So that is an important concern. So at this point, from looking at the literature around the world, anybody who's looked at children it looks like at least in adolescence, there can be evidence of asymptomatic, widespread asymptomatic antibodies, which indicate that they have been infected and less likely to be have symptoms. In a large study in New York, for example, in many, many hospitals, that like a health network called Northwell, they published 5,700 cases of hospitalized patients in their system, and only under 200 of them were under 30 years of age. So in that giant healthcare system where they have very good care, only a small fraction of the people under 30 actually needed to be hospitalized. So there probably is a transmission going on in those populations. They're not getting very sick, it looks like, but I suspect there will be some degree of transmission from children, and that the extent of what that looks like and how to prevent it is going to be a big issue in the coming weeks and months.
Got it. More to learn. More to learn. Dr. Adams, you referenced this earlier. You anticipated my question, but I did just want to ask you briefly, because we want to go to questions from the folks who are listening. What would you say to patients who are concerned about coming into a hospital during this time of COVID crisis? I could tell you were anxious about people putting off a visit that really was called for, necessary. One last thought on this one before we move on.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I think it is important, and just people need to be reassured that it is very safe environment. We feel that we have gone to extraordinary measures to make it safe, and that you know, it's important to have those healthcare issues addressed. And in many ways, you know, being inside a facility like a hospital today is safer than being in, you know, a grocery store. So people know they have to go get groceries. I think, you know, getting your health care is just as important, if not more so.
Thank you. I think it's an important reminder and, frankly, important reassurance. Thank you very much.
And Supervisor Simidian, if I may, I want to remind everyone living in our community that in the Santa Clara County order, all health care has always been open. It's never been restricted. And so we really do, to Dr. Maldonado's point, want to make sure that kids do go in for their immunizations, that people do access the regular care that they need. And healthcare facilities are safe places. So I just wanted to really, really emphasize that. There are no restrictions.
Thank you very much. That's Dr. Sarah Cody, who is our county's public health officer, adding her voice to the exhortation that folks who require health care should go get health care even during, and perhaps particularly during, this challenging time. Again, if you have a question you'd like to ask, please simply press 9 on your phone and we'll get you in the queue. And before we start to take those questions, so get ready, because I'm about to call folks out by their first name and their city, I do want to share the poll results from today. And for those of you who've been on the phone with us for a while now, you'll recall that I asked what the most significant concern folks was from among a list of four about the COVID-19 outbreak. And let me just say, we first asked these questions back on April the 5th, asked again on April the 26th, 3 weeks later, asked again on May the 17th, that would be today. And two noteworthy, I think, observations. One is that when we started back on April the 5th, 54% said that they were most concerned about the potential for the virus to overwhelm our hospital and healthcare system. That dropped down to just 27% by April the 26th, and today it's just 13%. So literally a quarter of what it was 6 weeks ago. So I think good news, you know, is quite apparent that our hospital and healthcare system has managed to keep up, and that is in large measure due to the efforts of folks who are on the phone who were part of the effort to flatten the curve, so thank you all. And then where there's been a growing concern, when we asked the question 6 weeks ago, less than 20% said the economy or the impact of the virus on small business was the thing that most concerned them. That pushed up to over 30% by our second call a few weeks back. And today, it is the leading concern, with 40% of the respondents today saying that their greatest concern about COVID-19 is its potential impact on our economy, including our small businesses. So greater and greater comfort and confidence in the ability of our system to manage the potential growth of COVID-19, but more and more anxiety, if you will, about the state of our economy. And again, not a random sample, and certainly there are other concerns out there, but I thought those were telling indicators. So now we're going to get to your questions, and thank you all for your patience. And I'm going to ask questioners to be as crisp as they possibly can. I have, I believe, a young constituent named Ben who is on the phone from Los Altos. Can we go to Ben from Los Altos? And Ben, if you're on the line with us, what's your question, Ben?
My question is, when do you think that schools will reopen? Because I'm missing school, and I know everyone else. Like, could you just give, like, a rough estimate? And if you can, give, like what are you guys thinking for how they might look in the future?
Dr. Cody, James Williams, our county council. Dr. Cody, our public health officer. Thoughts about when schools might reopen and what that might look like?
I'll start and then pass the phone over to James. I would so much like to have schools open in the fall. My kids would like to go back to school. I know everybody would like to go back to school. The honest answer is we just don't know yet. There's going to be school won't, if we are able to reopen school, it won't be like it was in February and March when you were last in school, because there's, you know, people will be needing to wear masks. They'll be needing to stay farther apart. They might be in smaller groups. And probably some kids will still, even if school's open, would still need to be doing some distance learning. So we are working really hard with schools to try to figure this out. And we don't have an answer here. And I don't think anyone anywhere has an answer yet. But I do share your desire to get back to school.
Thank you, Dr. Sarah Cody. James Williams, our county council, your observations?
Yeah, I would absolutely echo what Dr. Cody said and just add this is something that we care a lot about and that we're working hard at with our partners at the County Office of Education, working with all the school districts. The other thing I would just note for everyone listening is this is one of the areas where it's late in the stages on the state's roadmap as well, and there's a lot of guidance at the state level. The state, of course, really through both funding and regulation and otherwise, is a big player when it comes to schools. And so part of it is also getting a better understanding of where the state is at and what the state is thinking about as we layer our local thinking on top of that.
And briefly, please, Mr. Williams, as our legal counsel, who is the decider on that question? Who gets to make the judgment about whether school will reopen in the late summer or fall?
Well, it's multi-layered. The state certainly has to permit it, so that's one. Second, there has to be agreement from the local health officers. So in our county, that's Dr. Cody. But then third, these are individual decisions that districts get to make as well. And so, you know, there are lots of pieces of this that absolutely are decisions at the district level too. And that's why we're working so closely in partnership with the Office of Education and through our schools unit here actually in the OC with all of the many school districts in our county, and there are many, over 30.
Thank you very much. We're going to go next to a question from Jean in Los Gatos. That's Jean in Los Gatos. Jean, I believe you have a question about masks. Are you still on the line?
I'm still here.
Thanks so much for your patience. Jean, what's your question?
Let's see. So my question has to do with masks. I think it's been pretty well proven that wearing masks directly helps prevent the spread of the virus. So given this, I'm curious why the Santa Clara County is only recommending using them and not requiring it. I've heard the reason is because it causes an extra burden on the police, but it would seem to me that that burden is vastly outweighed by the benefit it offers.
All right, we have a question from Jean and maybe a little bit of an opinion there as well, which is just fine. Thanks for that. Dr. Cody, I know you've gotten this question before. What would you like to share?
I want to share that face coverings in Santa Clara County is more than a recommendation. I completely agree with the caller. It is really, really, really important, very important prevention tool that everyone cover their face with a homemade face covering or mask when you are out and about in public, period. And James has a couple of additional comments.
Yeah, the one thing that I want to add is that with the last order that took effect on May 4th, face coverings are in fact mandatory in Santa Clara County in businesses or accessing any of the other facilities that are open. And that was a change that was made as part of that order. So that's still a little different than some of the neighboring jurisdictions in terms of the mandate, but it's uniform in the sense that it is mandatory in entering any open businesses or other facilities.
And this is Dr. Adams, and I would add to that, I'm glad that question came up, that the closed space is, there's a big difference between outdoors and closed space. Closed space is where the contact transmission tends to occur, not so much outdoors, as long as you keep you separated from people. So this is really, it's a contact mostly. The respiratory droplets don't go right from person to person, but they go to a space or a surface, and then touching that goes to the person. So that's why there's a little bit of difference there. The other thing I have to mention is gloves. I see people wearing gloves. That is not a good idea. That is not a good idea to wear gloves. So when I do surgery, I wear gloves. I wash my hands. I put on gloves. I do the surgery. I immediately take the gloves off and throw them away and wash my hands. That's how gloves work. If you're wearing gloves all day, I see people driving in their car with gloves. That's how you spread the virus. That is not providing any protection for anybody. When you're touching things with your gloves, you're spreading the virus. So keep that in mind. I see that quite a bit. I think people are mistaken about what gloves really can do.
All right. Dr. Cody, you want to get the last word on gloves just before we set off a firestorm of phone calls with questions here?
No. I think we're all good. I mean, the only if you use gloves where you're touching something where you think that you want to protect yourself from the virus, I agree. After that, you take off your gloves and wash your hands.
So the reminder, Dr. Cody, and I don't want to be a physician here or pretend I am, but the reminder, it sounds to me like, is if you're using gloves, there are a short-term proposition for a specific purpose, and then they are called disposable gloves because they are disposed of. Did I get it right?
That is absolutely correct, because the big idea is you want to keep your hands clean.
Got it.
So if you're wearing a glove that's dirty, you're not doing yourself a service.
All right. We have a call from and a question from David in Sunnyvale. That's David in Sunnyvale. I believe it's about the efficacy of our test. So let me see. David, are you still on the line with us?
I am.
And your question, sir?
So the question has to do with tests and the accuracy of them. There's been a lot of concern, obviously, including the White House, evidently. So that's the question. Does the county have a real good, honest, effective test that can result in an answer within 24 hours?
All right. Dr. Cody, what do you think?
Yes. We have tests in our both in our public health laboratory and in our Valley Medical Center hospital, where we can have a pretty fast turnaround. The tests are high quality. I want to say that countywide, there's a variety of different tests being offered in a variety of different labs, And the lab that does the highest volume, and at this moment is actually serving the highest number of county residents, is the test being offered by Stanford. And so I would invite Dr. Maldonado to make any additional comments.
Dr. Maldonado, any thoughts you care to share?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that question. I do think, let me just say overall, that that's a critical question. It's very important to make sure, and I've been saying this to different providers as well, that people need to understand the limitations of their tests. They're all different. Different companies make different degrees of accuracy, tests that with different degrees of accuracy. So it's really important to understand what that test means, whether there's a risk of, there's always a risk of a false positive or a false, more importantly, a false negative. And I want to make sure people get that information if they can from the people who are providing these tests, especially the drive-through tests through some of these pharmacies, which have a fairly low accuracy, and I'd be very careful with those tests. But we at Stanford have been testing, built our own tests of our own in our own laboratory with FDA approval on March 4th. So it's been over 2 months now. We've done over 50,000 tests for the virus by PCR and also about 20,000 plus antibody tests to look for evidence of infection. And our accuracy is extremely high with very, very low rates of false negatives and false positives. I would say less than 1% on either side. So we are also, just so everybody knows, we are offering through our Stanford healthcare system a free testing for any first responders and essential workers who would like to be tested. You need to call in to the Stanford number and register first. And I will make sure that Dr. Simidian, I just gave you a degree, Supervisor Simidian has access to that number, because we would like we've already tested our first responders in the peninsula once, but we recognize that people might want to have access to those tests.
Thank you for that. We're going to go now to Mark from Mountain View, and this is a question I think I'm going to direct to our county council, James Williams. Because it's a question about who gets to decide what. And so let me go to Mark in Mountain View and let you articulate your question if you're still on the line with us. Mark, welcome.
Yes, hi. So I understand why the public health officials should be able to state their findings and give their advice and recommendations publicly. I guess what I don't understand is why the elected officials, say the county officials, aren't making the decisions for what should be open or closed within the county.
And let me just say, and I do not mean this flippantly, Mark, that is certainly a question that has come up more than occasionally. And in fact, the reason I know that our county council, James Williams, is prepared to answer the question is because I raised this issue with him some weeks ago. And so let me go to you, Mr. Williams, to share what state law provides in terms of who's in charge of what. James Williams, county council.
Absolutely. So the authority around these local health orders and state health orders comes from the Health and Safety Code, and the legislature made the determination that these decisions should be made in the first instance by county health officers, and that the regulation and oversight of those actions would come from the state health officer who's appointed by the governor. And so the state health officer does have the authority to do regulation, to make changes or impose statewide regulations or even supersede actions of local health officers. And in fact, in this case, we do have the state order, and the state order sets a floor on what we can do, and we can't go below that floor. So that's the framework that was set up, and you know that's the legal framework within which we operate. I won't speculate too much as to the rationale behind it, but my guess is that it had to do with wanting to vest these decisions in folks who are doctors, who have specific responsibilities and training, and having that mechanism have the oversight from the State Department of Public Health, rather than residing elsewhere. And so that is the framework we have. That's actually sometimes true for other areas of work that counties do. There's actually many bodies of work that counties do where there is this somewhat similar type of structure. And, you know, it can be sometimes confusing, but it's that's the statutory framework we have here in California.
Thanks. And James Williams County Council, I'm going to just sort of use a quick example to help folks understand this one, because I think it's baffling to a lot of folks. And I don't say that meaning good or bad. I just mean it's not what folks are used to. So, for example, a few weeks ago, there was some community concern about whether or not gardeners could perform their duties or whether nurseries could or should be open. And as the request came into my office on this relatively specific set of issues, we were obliged to tell folks that even if the Board of Supervisors voted 5-0 to reopen the nurseries, that we could not overrule the best judgment of our public health officer. Please tell me that I told people the right thing.
That is exactly right. And in fact, more so than just that, there are some of those categories where even locally we're limited by what the state has dictated.
Got it. And again, as I say, this is not the norm. It's certainly unfamiliar, I think, to a lot of folks who say, well, why don't you all just do this? And the short answer is that state law vests this authority in the public health officer. And as you pointed out, the one locus of power where somebody can say, no, we got a different take, is the state's public health officer as well. So thank you for that. All right, then let's go to Janet in San Jose. That's Janet in San Jose. And Janet, I believe,
Hello.
Has a question about Janet, I think your question is about patients who had COVID but then get readmitted. Do I have it right?
Yes, ones that have been in an ICU and then get discharged. Do we have any data about how many have to go back into the hospital?
Anybody on the line want to lean in on that one?
Yeah, so this is Dr. Maldonado from Stanford. I don't have specific national data on readmission. There's very little data looking at that question. So I'm actually heartened by that in the sense that there's when you read the literature on what happened to people, for example, the 5,700 people from New York State who were hospitalized, I don't recall that there was a large issue around readmissions, although I'm sure there were some. More importantly around the same issue, though, is a very important, much more common question related, which is, how long are people sick after they become infected? And that's an area that is still being studied, because it turns out that there are people who can actually stay infected for weeks and weeks, and that's not actually very uncommon. So it is the case that many people get sick and then get better after a number of weeks, and then there's no other issues. But more and more we are starting to see that there are people, I've seen several now, who have become PCR negative with no symptoms and then had symptoms again with a PCR positive again. And the question is whether they're being reinfected or just never cleared the virus. And there's a lot of evidence just circumstantially that this is probably reflects the virus just not being cleared very quickly from some people. I don't know enough yet to know whether that has to do with age or underlying conditions, but it certainly does seem to be the case where people can be sick for more than a couple of weeks. And I think that can be anxiety provoking, but at the same time, we know that most of those people are experiencing relatively mild symptoms. That is, they're not sick enough to have to be readmitted to the hospital.
Thanks, Doctor. I've got a card here in front of me that says we've got a call from Elaine in Mountain View. And Elaine in Mountain View has a question about why surrounding counties are in phase two. But Elaine, if you're still on the line, I'll let you ask the question.
Hi, thank you. Supervisor Savidian said it best, is that our confidence has been shaken because all the surrounding counties are able to enter phase two, but not us. And people are, as you know, are losing their jobs, losing their health benefits, other benefits. So why is it that we're still in phase one when the governor declared that we can enter phase two?
Dr. Cody, I'm going to let that one go to you.
Hi, thanks for the question. We are working as a region to move forward in a coordinated fashion to the best that we can based on the data that we see here locally. And I again want to emphasize that to the extent that we can reassure the community that the levels of transmission are low, it will be safer. And so when sectors do open up, we want customers and the public to feel safe and be safe accessing those services. So we are making our decisions based on our local indicators.
And Dr. Cody, I'm going to press you on behalf of both this caller and some of the others. So it sounds to me like you're saying each local public health officer in each county is making the judgment based on their own local data. Is that correct so far?
That is correct.
And that your next adjustment amendment to the existing order will be issued as soon as you feel like you've got the data that makes you comfortable we can do that in a way that is appropriate and safe and healthy. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
And anything else you want to share on that one, or have I pretty well covered the landscape on behalf of that caller and a number of others, by the way, who've got similar questions in?
I think you've covered it. Thanks so much.
All right. Yusra in Palo Alto. Yusra has a question about PPE, and I am struck by the question because there were all these terms and phrases that many of us were unfamiliar with just a handful of months ago, whether it was flattening the curve or now PPE. And why don't I go to Yusra and see what the question is. Yusra in Palo Alto, are you still with us? If not, Dr. Cody and Dr. Adams as well, the question was about whether or not we have sufficient PPE, personal protective equipment, for healthcare providers. Dr. Adams, you're on the front lines at El Camino. What's your experience?
Yeah, we have lots of supplies, lots of PPE equipment. Really, we have not had any shortages at all.
Okay. Dr. Cody, what are you seeing or hearing around the county?
I'll start to describe what the county level, and I'm going to invite James to chime in as well as EOC director. In general, our hospitals are in pretty good shape with regards to PPE. We have an entire part of our operations to ensure that that's the case and that we understand if hospitals have shortages. We still are having some challenges with gowns in some hospitals, low supply of gowns, and we're trying to get resources through the usual request mechanisms up to the state. James, what do you want to add to that?
Yeah, what I would add is that I agree the hospitals are in pretty good shape. We do have a medical supply unit within our logistics section here in the EOC that's just focused on these issues. Where we're getting a lot of requests are from smaller facilities, skilled nursing facilities, individual entities, first responder agencies. There are still a lot of supply chain challenges nationally, and those national supply chain challenges are still being felt very much locally. And so while we are able to obtain PPE, it's not the way it ought to be, is something that there still needs to be continued work at a national level so that we can return back to a place where we're able to do just-in-time type ordering and be able to get all the supplies that we need.
Thank you all. And let me just go to Michael in Mountain View. Michael in Mountain View has a question about parades and drive-bys. Michael, are you still with us?
Yeah, I sure am. Thank you, Joe, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm wondering whether the county administration would think about reconsidering the policy of prohibiting parades and drive-bys, particularly since we're coming up towards graduation. If you've got a situation where teachers and administrators are maintaining social distance within and outside the cars, where we're all wearing masks and all events are taking place outside, those are consistent with the state and the national health guidelines. And as far as I know, Santa Clara County is the only county in the state that is not allowing those. And I'm wondering if anybody on the call would care to comment or explain.
I'm going to go to James Williams, the legal counsel on this, because I know what the question he's gotten and is prepared to answer. James
Absolutely.
Williams, County Council.
We've certainly gotten this question. I think there's a couple really important points around this. First of all, the language on this actually is not any different in the Santa Clara County order from all of the neighboring Bay Area jurisdictions. It just seems to have been focused on our county. But really what it comes down to is the definition of, you know, travel under the order. It's something we're definitely looking at. But if you go back to a comment I made way at the beginning of our conversation around what is the kind of premise behind a shelter-in-place order, it really was focused on allowing travel for essential purposes. And so this was never encompassed right from the beginning of the first order in March, and it carried through to the current order as a category of essential travel. And so that's really where it comes from. There's nothing specific regarding it. It's just not right now a piece of an allowed essential travel. And like I said, that's actually true across the orders in the Bay Area. But it is something that we're definitely looking at closely. It is, you know, something we've heard from a lot of people about, you know, probably is a category that is certainly, I think everyone does agree, it's a lower risk type activity.
Thank you, Mr. Williams, and I'm not going to try and be a mind reader or a predictor, but it sounds to me like we got a pretty broad hint there that at least the matter is being looked at carefully for clarification in the future. Thank you for that. Let me go to James in Cupertino, and James in Cupertino has a question about landlord rights. James, are you still with us? Let me try one more time. James, are you still with us?
Yes.
Thanks. What's your question, please? And James, I'm sorry we can't hear you or pick you up, but if you give a call to my office tomorrow, the 408 number is 408-299-5050, and we'll try and get a response to your question at that time. And then we have a question from Patty in Mountain View, but that question has already been answered, so thank you, Patty. We will move on to a question that is from, I believe it's Deepu, and forgive me if I've mispronounced it, in Sunnyvale, on a topic that we touched on earlier. Deepu, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Can you tell us your question?
Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. So the question is with respect to elective surgeries. So my wife needs this surgery for carpal tunnel on her hand, but Kaiser has been telling her that it's an elective surgery, so they can't do it, which seems a little bit contradictory to all the comments the panelists made about getting regular health care. So I was wondering if you could clarify that for me.
Thank you for the question. Let's see if anybody can help, understanding that we have no one from the Kaiser system on our call today. Anybody want to weigh in, however?
Well,
This is Dr. Maldonado. I can talk a little bit about what we're doing at Stanford, and I'm sure Dr. Adam may want to say something as well. But I know at Stanford we have really opened up all of our surgeries now, as we have been allowed to by the state and the county, as you heard before. So we are really getting to ramp up. We're about 70% to 80% of our normal surgical capacity now in the hospital, and taking as many of our elective cases as we can. But I think it depends on your health system and what their capacity is and what they think they may be able to do. And just so you know, I did get an email from a patient about a particular procedure, and we are still under, and I think Sarah and James may be able to address this, we are still under some specific orders around certain types of, for example, cosmetic surgery prohibitions. But this does not sound cosmetic, but there are some nuances to that. I know at Stanford, again, we're open for business.
Dr. Adams?
Yeah, very similar. We're now 2 weeks into resuming elective procedures, and it has been going very well. But I think it really is up to the health system. You know, I think Kaiser has to make their own decision based on, you know, the resources that they have. You know, one of the things that we really decided before restarting elective procedures was our ability to test everyone to make sure, doubly sure, it's a safe environment. Of course, we use PPE, but we also wanted to make sure that we could test everyone. And so that was really a big factor in our decision. And so, yeah, we have been doing elective procedures.
Thanks so much. I've got a question from I want to get one more question in, if I can, please, from Kevin in Campbell. And let's see if we can get to Kevin in Campbell, if he's still on the line, who had a question about contact tracing.
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Kevin, thanks so much for hanging in with us through the whole call. What's your question?
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. The we're 2 months into the lockdown and shelter-in-place order. Where are we seeing new cases arise of the COVID-19 virus? I'm wondering if we're doing enough contact tracing to understand the origins of new cases.
Dr. Cody?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So that's something, of course, we're very interested in knowing, because it goes to the larger question of when is it safe to take a next step in reopening. And now I would say about 40% of our cases we don't know where they come from, and the other 60% we don't know where they come from. So it's either a household member of a case that we know, or it's within a congregate facility where we do like pretty intensive outbreak investigations, and we're seeing fewer and fewer cases in skilled nursing facilities. And there are certain neighborhoods and communities that have been disproportionately affected. You can look on our website now, there's a map. So for example, there are some neighborhoods where over time there's been more transmission, and that's still the case, although in all, even the areas with more spread, it's quieting down. I also just wanted to take a moment in response to the question earlier around elective procedures. Our order has never prohibited elective procedures or any procedures, including cosmetic. So it's all been really up to the healthcare systems to decide what their capacity is to do particular kinds of care.
Thank you all. Regrettably, we are at the point where I need to wrap up the call with thanks for all who were able to join us, and particularly for our panelists, County Counsel James Williams, our public health officer, Dr. Sarah Cody, and Dr. Maldonado from Stanford, and Dr. Adams from El Camino Hospital. I do want to not only thank these folks, but thank everybody who was on the call. Regrets to those of you whose questions we could not get to, particularly if you hung on the call all the way through. I should just mention my office number is 408-299-5050, 408-299-5050. And if you have an outstanding question, give my office a call Monday through Friday, and we'll do our level best to make sure that we find someone who can give you an authoritative answer. And, of course, you can always access us by email just by going to the County Supervisor Joe Simidian website. And, again, many of these questions can be addressed and are updated on the Public Health Department's page. I do also want to mention that we have been taping the call. We'll post it on my webpage, the County Supervisor Joe Simidian webpage, in the days ahead. The first two calls are also available there. Friends tell me it is great for folding your laundry by. So if you've got a little time on your hands and want to give it a listen or refer a friend who couldn't make the call. All of this information will be readily available. And I also want to say that if you want to simply offer a comment, make sure that your point of view is heard, or leave a message, just stay on the line after this call has ended. You'll hear a tone, and at that sound of the tone, you can leave a message. And again, I get them all, and I want to assure people of that. I either listen or they are just transcribed and available for me to read, and I read them. So thank you for those. I would be particularly interested in knowing whether you think it would be helpful for us to hold yet another town hall a few weeks from today. We had scheduled these first three, and then we're at a place now where we want to assess whether or not folks are finding them useful. So please feel free to share your comments in that regard. And the closing comment before we really do wrap it up here is just to underscore something that was said at the outset of the call, and that is thank you to every single one of the community members who is making this shelter-in-place order work. As some of the callers have alluded to, and as I certainly have occasion to observe, for some in the community, this is at a minimum a substantial inconvenience or aggravation. For others, it has real-world economic consequences, wages that are not being earned, savings that are being depleted, businesses that are struggling and stretched to their outer limits. Please know that I know that. I am mindful of it. As you heard earlier, the decision on the public health order comes from the public health officer as a matter of law, but please know that she is listening to all of us in the community and certainly to those of us who are communicating our concern about health issues first and foremost, but about other issues as well. With that being said, my thanks. This is County Supervisor Joe Simidian. I hope you have found this last hour and a half worthy of your time on a Sunday morning and afternoon. Take care.